This is Bill Bell Chambers, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 12th of December, 2011. Bill Bell Chambers, Part 2.
There were, Bill, one or two rather unusual incidents in your first couple of years at Halley back in the 50s. One in particular concerns a leopard seal.
Yes.
What happened there?
Well, Robin Smart, the base leader, and I used to go down to Emperor Bay, as it was called then, quite often, mainly to look at the penguins, because he was doing a study of them. And there were no penguins on this trip when we went down, but we went down to the... there was open water. There was sea ice, but there was open water out, farther out. And we approached the ice edge, and there was this... what turned out to be an elephant, a leopard seal. But Robin was convinced it was a seal. Well, I'd seen seals before, both the crab eater and the Weddell seal, and this looked like a different thing altogether. So I thought at the time it was, because of his head too, that it was a leopard seal, but it just sat there, you know, with his head on the... And Robin went up to it and even tapped it on the nose. And I stood back. I wasn't convinced. Anyway, a little... we both withdrew a bit, and then suddenly this... leopard seal leapt out, and we both ran. And I'm convinced that all that saved us was that we'd taken off our packs and put them on the sea ice.
Your rucksacks?
The rucksacks. And this seal stopped to look at them. And by that time we were out of range.
Were you ever reunited with your rucksacks?
Oh, yes, the seal went back in, eventually into the water. Robin was not convinced, even afterwards, that it was an elephant seal.
Leopard seal.
Leopard seal, rather, yes.
The midwinter's dinner,
yes.
Which nearly turned into a bonfire.
Yeah. Well, we were all sat down at a table, and Robin had this silver... lamp, a spirit lamp, you know, which had been given him by his fellow officers, I think. He decided he'd light it, but he put paraffin in it. And suddenly the whole thing flashed up, and he jumped back. But David Cansfield, who was the fire officer, we had a fire blanket, and he managed to smother it. But the reason was, he put cold paraffin into the lamp, which then expanded, you see, and of course it overflowed, and it just went.
Robin Smart, your base leader, was he accident prone? Because it was him that had a medical problem.
Yeah, he fell on the ice at Emperor Bay, not while I was there, but I wasn't with him at the time. But he had the camera inside his anorak.
A what?
His camera.
Camera.
Yeah. And he fell down, and this, I think, punctured a, broke a rib, which then punctured a bile duct. And, he was very bad, and It was touch and go with him at one time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh, yes.
What time of the year was this?
Sorry?
What time of the year was this? Was this in the winter?
I'm just trying to think. Well, I think it was early spring, it must have been.
So it was possible, yeah, okay, so an evacuation was possible.
Not then.
No.
Not in those days, no. No, there was no possibility of getting him out.
So what was done about it, Bill?
Well, they got medics, London giving advice, and I remember the carpenter built a wedge to keep his knees up, and I think that helped a bit, but we didn't have the medicine that was necessary on the base, but they did have some down at Shackleton. And Fuchs agreed to send up the plane as soon as they could dig it out with the medicine. And they also sent up their doctor. Although we put out a beacon for them to home on, for some reason they went right by. I think they were following the ice cliff, and then they got the ice cliff of the Dawson Lambton, and so passed south of us. Anyway, they were getting short of fuel, so they had to land, and they were about 70 miles north of us. But then folks decided to send up the Otter to locate them.
Mm-hmm.
And which they did. But I always remember listening to them on the radio, because Alan Rogers, the doctor, Shackleton, was phoning in England. I don't know where it was laid from, but he was talking about him flying over the Dawson Lambton, and it was a bit of a joyride for them, I think. Anyway, I prepared a sledge and a tractor to take us out to where we thought they were. But Fuchs said not to go until, unless the weather got worse, not to go until John Lewis, the pilot of the Otter, had tried. So we never went. But they refueled the Oster, and they both flew into Helly Bay with no problems.
And what happened to Robin?
Well, Robin was able to, by that time, was on the men. He was able to walk out and meet them. Yeah. But no, we were very worried about him at one time.
Mm. But he recovered fully, did he?
Yes, he did. And he got promoted to Major General afterwards.
Where was Fuchs at this time? Was he not actually on the TAE by then?
Yeah, TAE.
So he was phoning instructions from his tractor somewhere in the Antarctic. When he said Fuchs arranged for, agreed for the sender.
No, Fuchs was still at base at Shackleton.
Ah, right.
Yeah, they hadn't started yet.
But when it did start, were you able to follow its progress at all? At the TAA across the continent?
Well, yes, at times we did. But I didn't listen in much, but I was never impressed with Fuchs as a leader.
Why not? What was missing?
What was missing was getting people to do things. He left them to their own resources, and things didn't get done. And we let two people go down to help them out, and they were absolutely disgusted with the state of the place down there. But he was such a nice chap, Bunny. But he couldn't tell people this must be done, you know, or that must be done. He delegated, but he didn't follow up to see it was done, which was, in my view, surprising.
Whilst we're still talking about Robin Smart, the reason why he was in the Emperor Bay was to try and find out about the mating habits of emperor penguins.
Yes.
What did you discover?
Well, we'd been going down quite a lot, normally during normal day hours, even though it was winter. We never saw any sign of any sexual activity at all. And the view that was expressed at that time, I recall, was that the emperor penguins mated before they came down.
Right.
I suggested to Robin one day, perhaps we should go and camp out at night, as they might be like some humans. and we went down and picked a tent on the sea ice there. There was something like 100,000 emperor penguins there, all hooting away, you know. And every so often we go out and have a look round and see whether anything was happening. And then suddenly we saw two of them at it. Then it was quite a common thing.
So they mated at night?
Well, yes.
Even though it was daylight?
No, it wasn't daylight.
It wasn't. No. That was winter, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And you were able to establish a gestation period then?
Yes, that's right. Mm. Yeah.
Was this the first time it had been observed, the gestation period?
Well, we thought it was, but I understood that the French at Dura Daly had discovered the same thing a few days before us.
Oh.
So I was told. I don't know.
I've got the sledging report here from your 1957 expedition where you're using the original 6-foot manhole sledges. It was Easter Sunday, 1957. Oh, there's one single day journey of 26 miles took place on Easter Sunday, 57. And then the next real chance to go sledging was not until after the winter was over.
Uh-huh.
And that's when you put together your super-duper sledge, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, the first time we took the sledge, I can't recall what the date was, but it was only a two-day affair, I think.
During the winter, Bell Chambers dismantled the two worst of our 6-foot sledges and made one 10-foot, 6-inch man-hauling sledge.
That's right.
The upsweep of the runners in front was increased by steaming and bending. Ground clearance was increased and the rear handlebars were fitted, whispering bells. And then the compass was fitted to the rear handlebars.
Yeah.
Manhole harnesses were made out of broad canvas and terralene rope was used to make the traces. But we had no sledging wheel. TAE kindly supplied us with some of their spare meters. And it was the intention to make a wheel, but this was never done. Therefore, all routes and distances had to be worked out from bearings taken on fixed points. For 1958, a 12-foot manhole sledge with Tufnell runners has been requested, complete with sledging wheel and meter. Did it ever arrive?
Yeah, it did.
It did?
Yeah.
Jolly good.
Yes, it did. It wasn't popular.
It wasn't?
No, because it was the bendy.
Ah, yes. Okay. Let's move on then to... How many years were you there in the 50s? How many winters did you do in the 50s?
Four. I did 57, 58, and then 63, 64, 65.
Right, so let's move on then to the 60s. What happened in the 60s, 63, to lead you to go back south again?
Well, the Royal Society asked if I would go again for the International Years of the Quiet Sun. That was the opposite of the IGY, when the sunspots were rarest. I mentioned earlier Dr. Pickett, he wanted me to go as well. I thought it would make a nice pair of researchers, Sunspot Max and Sunspot Min.
How would they know it was going to be a year of minimum sunspot activity?
Well, they can't be sure. That's why it's a year long. But normally it's an 11.5-year cycle.
That had been observed over
yes,
the last few
yeah,
decades.
Over the last 100 or so years. Precisely when it comes, you don't know.
Mm.
But in measuring it, having it as a year, you're sure to get it, the peak or the lowest number.
And why was it valuable to witness that and to record it?
Well, as there was likelihood of being little activity on the sun, then there should be fewer storms.
Mm.
And so the main effect on the Earth would be solely the solar rotation.
Right, so you were able to kind of get a base reading, if you like.
Yeah.
An uninterrupted or undisturbed...
That's right.
...set of readings.
Mm.
Okay. Good, thank you. And you did some sledging on that trip as well, a bit more organised this time.
Yes.
There was a trip in November, for 3 weeks, in November to December 64, and you were going out to set up a new... ionospheric station, a remote station. So we got to the point now where there were stations outside the Halley Bay base itself.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, it was rather strange how it happened, really, because...
Oh, good.
when I was at Radio Space preparing to go south the second time... there appeared in the equipment room there an American ionoson, which was only about this size.
Large suitcase.
I can't remember what the number was. And I thought to myself, that's useful. You could carry that on a vehicle, you know. And so I asked if they'd like to give it to me for the expedition. Because I then thought, while we could measure drifts at Halley Bay, drifts of the ionosphere, we couldn't tell whether they were just localised phenomena or a much broader one. And I thought, if we can get Belgrano and Halley Bay and this other station which I said, we could measure the drifts over that area. Now, I then had to find... some mobile generators. And of course, I didn't have much money in the budget, because Byron at Aberystwyth, who was controlling the budget, wanted as much as the grant as he could get for his university. Anyway, I got two small petrol generators. And again, I suppose I made a mistake, because up on the plateau, the air is drier and the slip rings wear rapidly on the generator. And that was the trouble. They broke down after a while. So we didn't get a very long run. Also, the ionograms which I got from Belgrano weren't very good quality. So although we could see one or two features, it wasn't really a scientific job. But of course, they measured up. They did meteorology out there as well. There were two of them left in this caboose. As Fuchs said, it opened the way to the pole that way. Gordon Barrow, he was a doctor on the second spell. He'd done a lot of sledging down there, and he led the team as far as the route was concerned. But I must admit that the trip from the ice shelf up onto the plateau was a bit hairy. 25 miles of crevasses. And but I will say the tractor drivers knew their job, because when you start to go, there's only one way you're going to get out, and that is give it a gun and keep climbing, because you'll get rid of the soft snow and you'll get some harder stuff underneath, and you get out. And that happened several times. Well, not several times, three or four.
In the sledging report, this is November, it's 1964, you are now ascending, and you reach stake 1052 at about 6,000 feet. Although as a barometer was broken, there was no way of checking this. The effect on the vehicle performance was considerable. So presumably the high altitude really didn't... The tractors didn't like the altitude, is that correct?
They didn't pull as well on the high altitude, the muskegs. Yes, because we had a big load going out. We had to pick up drums as well, fuel. Coming back was no problem because we lighted loads. And also, I suppose we were coming downhill.
And the ionospheric station you set up only lasted for a short time, you say?
Yes. It was only active for a short time, for about 6 weeks, I think.
And how were the results, generally speaking? Did he get what you wanted in terms of the low sunspot activity readings? Not from the outlying one?
Not from the outlying one. No. It's regrettable, but I have to admit it was a bit of a failure.
Okay.
From an ionospheric point of view.
So did you enjoy it?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And was it different being... Now you were working under FIDS, I guess.
Yeah.
So does that make a difference from the Royal Society? Was it better organised, worse organised?
There was more... I was going to say disciplined attitude, but...
More structure.
I think the Royal Society, once they gave you a job to do, they left you to do it. Whereas with Bass, there were always restrictions on certain things. I say restrictions, limitations is probably better.
But that would be because Bass was more aware of what might go wrong.
Possibly, yes, possibly.
I'm thinking now, of course, of the following year in October 65 when the Muskeg went down the Totten failure, a crevasse, and three guys were lost, weren't they? Wild, yep. Wilson and Bailey.
Yeah.
What was your first knowledge of that?
I was listening on the radio because we hadn't heard from them. And in the ionospheric hut, I had a very good receiver there. So I used to listen for the broadcast.
What did you hear? Did you hear Ross himself?
Yeah. And then I realised there was this terrible tragedy. And I went across to the main hut and they'd got the message too.
They knew as well, did they?
Yeah, they'd heard the message.
They'd heard themselves.
Yeah. It was a disaster. It should never have happened, in my view.
Why do you say that, Bill?
Only one other person knows my views on this, and that's Gordon Bower. But the apart from Die Wild, none of the others had any dog training. They never did any dog training during the winter or the early spring. So none of them really, including Ian Ross, didn't know how to drive a dog team. The other thing is that they were late in the season, and while this has some attractions in that you can often see the lids of crevasses late in the season, at the same time, a lot of the lids are stronger early in the season, so you can you know, in the late in the season, there's a slight curvature in the where the lid sinks slightly, and you can see the lines, whereas early in the season there's no sinking lid. And it's stronger too, you see. And so this is the third problem I had, is that this equipment which they had supposedly for detecting crevasses. Now, this wasn't a big crevasse. I've got a picture somewhere of it. It was a work of art to get a tractor down it. If the tractor had stayed where it was, it couldn't have gone down. But because it stuck its nose down it went. And of course, squeezed everything. But the I'll come back to the point I made earlier. When you get onto a crevasse, there's only one way out. And if you don't take it, you're gone. And I think what they did, they detected a crevasse, put the brakes on, nosedived. That's my view.
What difference does the fact they hadn't worked with dogs make? Because the dogs weren't actually in the front, were they?
No.
Should they have been?
No, that's all right. But you see, Ian Ross, who was sitting on the back sledge with the dogs, had never driven dogs. So when they went down, he was saved. The sledge had balled up on the crevasse. So he then tried to harness the dogs and get back to the depot where there was a radio, because everything had gone down the crevasse. And he went around for 2 days, apparently, as my understanding, trying to get the dogs to behave, to get back to the base. Not the base, but the depot.
The depot, yeah.
Yeah.
But that wouldn't have saved anybody, would it? My reading of the situation is that they were all dead more or less straight away. One lived a bit longer, but
one lived a bit longer, it's true. And Ian said that he could hear the screams, and he decided he couldn't go down, and he'd stay until it was all quiet.
One of the theories I heard, and it might have been Gordon Barrow, was that they should always have the dogs in the front before the tractor.
Well, that is a good way of proceeding.
Because the dogs would detect the crevasse.
Yeah, because dogs have a sense about these things. A good dog leader does, anyway. But then you've got to drive the dogs. Yes, I hadn't thought about that, but no, there's ways around it, but you'd have to have the dog team separate from the tractors. I'm not sure, though, when you think about this, whether if the dog team had been up front, whether this would have been any different, because the dog team would have probably just run straight over it, no problem.
Mm. Two questions then, really. One is, what was it like back at base? That's a bit of a crass question, but I'd be interested to know what your answer is. And I'll come to the second one in a moment.
Well, of course, we were all a bit depressed. I was particularly upset because I was very fond of Di Wild. Mm. He used to come over to the Inis Ferry Cup when I was on night watch and sit there, and we used to chat. But the other thing, of course, was that Ian Ross would have been in the tractor if he hadn't swapped with the doctor. Now, the doctor couldn't stand the cold. That was the reason. I mean, he should never, in my view, should never have been allowed to go on that, because he couldn't stand the cold. And there we get Ian Ross lets him have a place in the cab because he's so cold. Fortunately, Ian is saved and he's dead.
Did anything change? Did practices or procedures change as a result of the accident? Did they rethink the way they went about that kind of travel or that kind of expedition?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge.
You were there south on that occasion for just two more years, for the winter of 64 and 60.
65, 65, 66. Yeah. Oh,
64, 65,
yes.
Yeah, and then you came out.
Yes.
Was that? Did you know that was going to be the last time you ever go to the Antarctic? Or was it the last time?
It was the last time.
Yeah.
But, no, I didn't think I'd go again.
Did you not work for them again, though, at some point?
Yes. I used to lecture sometimes at Cambridge. When I was in the back in the ministry, I had a lot of contact with folks.
Why? What sort of contact was that?
Well, we were trying to get them to get Bass to register their frequencies that they were using, and folks didn't want to do that.
Why not?
He wanted to remain more flexible, and also the fact that they never had registered any frequencies. So why do it now? But the thing was that if they were registered, they could get some protection. Mm. Whereas the situation that existed was that they had no protection anyway.
Was that symptomatic of the of FIDS at that time, that it was really a one-man band? It was a kind of a monarch, and what he wanted went.
To a large extent. I mean, it was quite a small organisation still at that time. And Bill... I can't remember what he's...
Bill Sloman.
Mm. I was thinking of Eric Salmon. But yes. He used to rule the roost. But it was a peculiar system in some ways, because governor in the Falkland Islands had a lot of say in things, you know. Because I suppose he had overall responsibility for what went on in British Antarctic. But, there was a chap, they had some sort of headquarters in Port Stanley as well. And
are you thinking of Johnny Green?
I do remember Johnny Green, yes. Mm. Yeah.
There was a gap of nearly 5 years between your first Halley trip and your second Halley trip.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a noticeable change in the conditions after 5 years' leave of absence? Was it much better than it had been in the IGY year as a base?
I don't think so.
It hadn't moved on.
Sorry?
It hadn't improved.
Not really. Some things were worse, some things were better, I think. But, of course, we now had another hut built on top of the other one. And leaks were always a problem, because the heat of the hut used to melt the snow, and it used to find a gap. So
the second hut was already underground by the time you got back down there, was it?
Oh, so it was underground before I left.
Yeah.
The first time.
The first hut, yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know when they took this other hut down, but it was already partly buried then. Mm. I mean, there was a big shaft up from the second one. So the yes, the second hut, as I recall, was already buried when I went down.
Had the beasties been upgraded between the 50s and the 60s?
Well, the only change that was made really was that instead of using 70 mil photographic paper, we used 35 mil film. That made a big difference, because it was easier to process the film than that 70 mil paper.
Mm. And what about communications with the rest of the planet? you know, surface communications, was it easier to get through to Stanley in London?
I think there was most of the time there was an improvement. Yes. We had a lot more. I remember I arranged with the ministry for their transmitter to be used for communication between Birdlip and base. Now, it worked for a while, but I think the real trouble was that they didn't have an aerial at Birdlip in the polar direction. Most of their rhombics were facing the North Atlantic, and the other one, the only other one, was Singapore. So they weren't prepared to put up an aerial, especially for this.
Can I pick on a couple of other things in your life, your working life, which aren't directly connected with the Antarctic, although I guess there must be some cause and effect? I was interested to read in the early 60s, working for the Ministry of Civil Aviation, that you worked on the effect of cosmic rays on the Concorde plane.
Yeah, well, that was due because I knew something about cosmic rays.
And in what way was Concorde affected by cosmic rays? I appreciate it was flying high.
Well, it's the radiation effect on people in Concorde that would have been the problem. Because cosmic rays will go through almost anything.
So the passengers were all being dosed up, were they?
Well, that was a possibility. Not under normal circumstances, but when you had a particular heavy burst, there was that possibility.
Did that come to pass at all?
No, not to my knowledge, no.
I mean, Concorde, I don't remember Concorde being grounded during sunspot activity.
No.
So you were trying to work out whether or not it would have any effect?
Yeah,
And there was no conclusion?
Well, the conclusion was that unless it was exceptional, it would be okay.
Okay. And you were involved in the automatic landing systems at Heathrow Airport.
Mm-hmm.
What was that, Bill?
Well, the idea was that you could measure the flight path of aircraft landing. You could measure the force which it hit the runway with. There were various things about this which at that time would have been useful to airlines. So I was appointed manager there, I was getting the system up and running. But unfortunately, workers used to quite often cut the cables. Oh, dear. Yeah, there wasn't much coordination between the works and the tower. And so that was always a setback when the cables were cut. But in the end, of course, the reliability of the automatic landing system, not the measuring system, the landing system itself, was becoming so reliable that because most of the landings, you probably know, automatic. No, pilot doesn't control it these days.
I wish you hadn't told me that.
Well, it's very reliable. He monitors in case anything should go wrong. But basically, it's they're monitors now to a large extent.
So you were in on the ground floor of that technology, were you? Is that the early stages of developing automatic landing?
Yeah.
Was your role purely management, or were you actually at the cutting edge of that
development? Well, I was developing the
technology.
Yes.
So it's down to you to a certain extent.
Hmm?
This automatic landing at airports is down to you to a certain extent, is it?
Oh, I wouldn't go that. I wouldn't go that far.
No, but you were in the team.
Yes.
Okay. And I might have got this wrong, but were you also involved in early development of mobile phones?
Yes, in many ways. From a frequency point of view, use of frequencies, yes.
Tell me a bit more about that, Bill.
Well, because everything was analog years ago, and the fact that the MOD had a lot of spectrum allocated to them, there wasn't much spectrum available for mobile telephones. I was always, one of the jobs I was doing was trying to see sharing possibilities. But also because I was responsible for engineering across the spectrum, that is from low frequency to very high frequencies, extra high frequencies. The only way we could find spectrum for mobile phones in those days was to get some of the spectrum back from MOD. But it wasn't just mobile phones. I mean, they controlled the spectrum for certain radars which we wanted to introduce, and they wouldn't give up the spectrum, and yet they weren't really using it. They put spectrum aside for a rainy day sort of thing.
How did you break that conundrum?
Sorry?
How did you break that conundrum?
Well, it's interesting because we arranged trials up on Salisbury Plain with equipment that they had, and from our point of view, the trials were quite satisfactory, and so the MOD. Allowed us to use the spectrum. But, of course, another aspect of it was that internationally, it was not supposed to be used for military purposes, that part of the spectrum.
In this wonderfully varied career that you've had, how does the Antarctic rate?
Well, today, I don't think about it much, but years ago it meant a lot to me because I think it helped my career.
So having done 4 years in the Antarctic wasn't a handicap. It was a good line in your CV, was it?
Well, it did me no harm. But I like to think that they thought I was a bit of a get up and go chap.
Most FIDs are. Why has it faded from your state? Why has it faded in status in recent years? You say you don't think about it much now. Is it simply because it's such a long time ago?
I think it's because it's a different world today. To us that went down in the 50s and 60s, it was a pretty hard life. Not that that worried us, but when you look back, it was a hard life. Whereas today, you don't have to get cold at all. Even the people go down for the summer. It's like a summer holiday for them. They've never wintered. There are people that winter, of course. But look at the conditions they got. Running water at Halley Bay now. Flush toilets.
Central heating?
Sorry?
Central heating.
Yeah, yeah. I don't begrudge them that. but it's a different world to what. And, you know, when people talk about the Antarctic, they're looking at today's situations. Perhaps this is why I said earlier that we weren't far different from Scott.
It's exactly 100 years since Scott reached the pole next month.
Yes.
And it's only in the last 30 years that things have changed, it seems to me.
Yeah.
After you stopped going.
Well, perhaps that's the reason.
you can't take the blame for that, Bill. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.